This is Open Minds Radio. Here again, your host, UFO paranormal researcher and journalist, Alejandro Rojas.
Ding, ding. I love that music. That's from Systematics. I don't know if I've plugged this guy in a while since we've been playing his music for the show, but a very cool listener, and I hope he still listens because this was like a year ago that he allowed me to start using his homemade music, which I find to be very, very groovy. But need I remind you, hello and welcome to Open Minds Radio, your UFO news authority. My name is Alejandro Rojas, and we have another remarkable show today. This is an exciting topic for me because I've always been curious about UFOs during World War II. Sure, I've heard of the Foo Fighters, and hey, I get excited about not just the Foo Fighters, which is where the name came from, the UFOs in World War II, but these were kind of these balls of energy that looked like fire. Also the Foo Fighters as a band, very cool band. They're obviously into UFOs. But our guest today, Keith Chester, is the author of a book called Strange Company, Military Encounters with UFOs in World War II. He's talking about not just Foo Fighters, but other types of UFO sightings during World War II. So I'm excited to talk to him about some of this stuff and some of his research into all of this. So this should be really cool. I don't think there are very many researchers, as far as I know, that really focus on World War II. So we should have a lot to learn here today. And I just love learning, and that's why I'm so excited about our guests. Yes, I say that all the time, excited about our guests. Now, I'll give you a little clue. If I say I'm not excited about the guests today, I'm probably a little iffy. But I'm sure our guests are wonderful because, to be honest, I've liked every single one of our guests except for one. And I'm not going to tell you who that is. Dozens of shows. You got to figure that out yourself. Maybe go listen to the beginning of every show to see which ones I say I'm excited about and which ones I don't. Maybe that'll give you a clue. Anyway, another thing that I'm excited about is the UFO Congress. And this is some exciting news, too. The latest and greatest, we are adding Paul Hellyer to our list of speakers. So, you know, we had him on the show. It was a great honor to have an actual cabinet member level person of a G8 country to come on to the show, retired, of course, and tell us about UFOs and about not only that. Some of you must have been excited because I know I was, you know, talking about the power elite and the big money people who are really running things behind the scenes. That's some pretty heavy stuff, man. So that was really cool. And he's going to be coming to the UFO Congress to talk about that. We've got some other people that have never actually come to speak at the Congress. In fact, another person who doesn't speak very often is Dr. Carol Rosen. She, of course, used to work with Wernher von Braun, the man that is coined as the father of modern rocketry, who brought a bunch of his guys over from Germany with Project Paperclip, and they really started, you know, working on the V-2s for the Americans and started working on the rockets and everything that took us to the moon and beyond. Of course, some people don't believe we ever went there, but they did build the rockets. You got to admit that. So she worked with him, and she talks about some of his talking about UFOs and things like that. We've got Linda Howe, and this is going to be unique because we're going to also have John Burroughs and James Pennison. So if you've read thoroughly your latest issue of Open Minds magazine, then you're going to be well-versed on the Rendlesham Forest incident, and you're going to know that John Burroughs and James Pennison were the two of the three guys that went out into the forest the first night to go examine the UFO that landed outside of Rendlesham Forest there, or in the forest outside of their base. So they're going to be there. It's going to kind of be this mini Rendlesham Forest reunion. which is important because it's the 30-year anniversary this year, although this is going to be early next year in February. As we wrap up 2010, good Lord, where'd it go? Still, you know, that's a rare occasion. Linda Howe hasn't spoken at the Congress before. Neither has Leslie Keene, who wrote the best-selling book. We had her on a few weeks ago. She was on the Colbert Report. Very media savvy person who wrote that incredible book about UFOs and generals and pilots and all of those great guys who wrote, including Fife Symington, about their UFO experiences. So we've got, you know, this is just a portion of the amazing lineup that we have at the Congress. You can see the rest at UFOCongress.com, and then you can actually register there. So this is a rare opportunity to see Paul Hellyer. He doesn't speak often, and he probably won't again. So he's also, and this, as far as I know, is the first time this has ever happened. Usually he comes in, does his talk, and he's out of there. But he's actually going to be hanging out. So you can get any of your books signed that you have of his. Maybe you have something else that you want to get signed. Maybe for some reason you were involved with some incursion having to do with Canada and you have some sort of Canadian shrapnel that was removed from your leg that you want to have signed by ex-Minister of Defense for Canada. I doubt that's happened. I mean, they're peaceful people up there. Much more peaceful than us down here. In America, we're just more, they have more right to be upset. They're up there in the cold. We're down here in the warm and the nice, and we're angry. We've got too much coffee. It's too much Starbucks, probably. But anyway, if you want to meet Paul Hellyer, this is going to be your chance. Because he usually doesn't kind of hang out. He usually, like I said, is in and out. So you're going to get to talk to him directly and ask him your questions. And it's a pretty incredible opportunity. So this is great. I'm very excited about the UFO Congress this year. It's going to be a lot of fun. And, of course, I mentioned the magazine. If you don't know much about Rendlesham, you're going to want to get our magazine so you can find out more about that whole incident before you come to the Congress so you can learn all about it. And you can actually do that this weekend. Pick up a copy if you're in the Bay Area or you're going to be there for the Bay Area UFO Expo. Open Minds is going to have a table out there, and we will be selling some magazines, some single issues, maybe some T-shirts, some hats. We'll be there getting subscriptions. That's a big one. We want to sign you up for our magazine for subscriptions, not just so that we can build up our subscriptions, but we want to make sure that you're informed of the latest and greatest, that you have pretty pictures of all the things going on in these news stories. You want to have that picture, you know, when Antonio Urzi or some of these guys, we're going to do a story on the famous Turkey UFO. If you don't know about, and I'm not talking about a UFO driven by a turkey, I'm talking about UFO video that was taken in Turkey in 2007, 2008, 2009, incredible stuff. You want to get the magazine so you can see the pictures there in high resolution and very pretty. That's why you're going to want to subscribe. It's very important that you do so. And you can do that right there live with us at the UFO Bay Area Expo this weekend. Otherwise, go to the website and then you'll be all prepared to join us at the Congress. You know, worst case, let's say you can only afford to come to the Congress. You can't get the magazine and the hats and stuff. Don't worry about it. Come to the Congress. Come tell me. Give me your sob story. I'll give you a hat. Okay? I'm not afraid to kind of help out those that need the help. Our radio show, I wanted to mention, is also about the day after the show. We posted on YouTube. Some of you might have noticed that. And it's in high resolution. So if you're not able to watch the video live during the show at our website, you can go to YouTube and you can watch it in high resolution where you can see, you know, pictures of our guests in the high res or Jason, our news correspondent. He comes up with some great pictures. He had a picture of Palin pointing at a UFO. And that was really cool. If you want to see that in high resolution, you can go to the website and check that out. Either way, Jason's also been put together a UFO video collection. Essentially, as many of you know, we inherited what's called the UFO Photo Archives of Wendell Stevens, and these are incredible pictures from decades that he's collected. We're putting them in stories on the website, and also Jason has put together a story video with those pictures in it, and we're going to be doing a lot more of that. So in order to keep up to date for free, you can go to YouTube. We offer a lot of stuff for free. I mean, our whole website. And this is another one. You can go to YouTube and subscribe. Please do that right now, in fact. Go to YouTube, open up, click the new window or new tab because you don't want to disrupt the listening that you're doing now. And go to YouTube and hit the subscribe button. You're really going to want to do that. Not enough people have. And then you're going to know the latest and greatest videos and everything that we have up. And we've got some cool ones coming up. We always have cool videos. And, you know, I'd be so excited if I were you guys. I'm excited sitting here now, but if I were you, knowing that I could get all of this up-to-date info in HD, you know, at the tip of my fingers there at my keyboard just for subscribing. However, speaking of Jason and all of the cool things to do that he does, he also, of course, is here with us every week. You may be worried because if you're watching live, you don't see him sitting next to me. I needed some more elbow room. Kicked him out into the control room. Actually, we're a person short, so he's in the control room. But on our website, we update on a daily basis some of the UFO headlines. Lots of UFOs in the news across the globe. And Jason is here on a weekly basis to update us on all of those UFO news. And he's here today in our control room. Jason McClellan, are you there to tell us all about the UFO news for the week?
I am, Alejandro. Greetings. And hello, world. This is your Open Minds news brief for Monday, October 25th, 2010. There was a particularly peculiar story out of China last week. Again, another China story. But this one was about an entire village being abducted by UFOs. A report claimed that several UFOs had flown over a village near Kinling, after which an entire village disappeared. The report also claimed that all roads leading to the village had been blocked off by military with tanks and missile launchers. It all turned out to be wild flying rumors. Some speculate that nearby spotlights were confused for UFOs. But as for the part about military and the abducted village, it appears that it was all a result of rumors spiraling out of control. And Alejandro, we have talked about rumors spiraling out of control the past couple of weeks in relation to comments made by Mark Pilkington in the book that he wrote, claiming that the military seeded information about UFOs. But then he also claimed that a lot of UFO stories tend to seed themselves and kind of spiral out of control because people start speculating, spreading rumors, and that's really all this turns out to be. I mean, we don't know for sure, but that's what the story seems to be so far.
Unidentified flying rumors is what they are.
Unfortunately, there are a lot of them.
And then they blow up and they become part of the mythology or part of what people believe. That's why it's so important. And that's one great thing, you know, a discipline that I think is great about what we do here is we're very careful about doing some research before and letting you know what research is out there before we say you substantiate something. And sometimes there's not much to substantiate something. And sometimes, unfortunately, there's some evidence that these unidentified flying rumors are identified, F standing for something else, hoaxes.
Yeah, and, you know, the internet is wonderful for information, but it's also terrible for information because, as we've mentioned also recently on shows, is that major news sources are using YouTube and just small blogs as their one news source, and they don't investigate beyond that. Mm-hmm. And this story about the village being abducted reports have said that that's where it stemmed from, was just a simple signature on a message board or something, and people took it out of context. And
well, you can
things.
Do that. I mean, right now, and I think people are really hypersensitive towards UFO information. If I was to make some video, put some pictures in there, and some information about having some sort of knowledge about UFOs in New York, that would take off, and people would start posting it all over the place. And it's an easy way that these people get hits on their YouTube videos.
That's right, and you make a good point that people are hypersensitive right now because of all the recent media and all the hype.
Mm-hmm.
There was another UFO sighting this week, or last week. Dozens of people reported seeing strange lights in the night sky above Richmond, Virginia. A newlywed couple suggested that the lights might have been from a wish lantern, which is similar to a Chinese lantern, they released during their wedding ceremony. But witnesses reported seeing three lights, and the three lights formed a triangle. So who knows?
Another one, tough call.
And similarly, in Texas, in El Paso, Texas, a sighting grabbed a lot of attention last week. Multiple mystery lights appeared in the sky. What appeared to be one falling light split into three separate lights, and then a fourth light appeared after that. Following the hype of this story, the executive director of a local air show came forward and claimed that the lights were from a patriotic performance by the U.S. Army's Precision Parachute Team. The director explained that each parachuter had canisters with flares attached to their feet to illuminate the sky while performing the synchronized stunt.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, they show the video of the stunt closer. You know, they even, in one of the videos we posted on this, they had some of the witnesses talk who had seen the stunt being performed, and the video matches completely. So this is one where the Texas UFO would seem to be these parachuters, and, you know, this isn't some kind of cover-up type of deal because they have, you know, plenty of evidence to show that.
Yeah, after watching the video, it certainly seems that the parachuting people with flares would make sense. But here's yet another story. A pair of UFOs were seen in Phoenix, Arizona on Saturday night. One witness provided this description: two meteors falling out of the sky with flames and sparks trailing behind them. They began turning and moving. The lights were going on and off. The flames and sparks would come and go. The local ABC affiliate says they received several calls about the sightings. The spokesperson for the fire department said the lights were parachute exercises, possibly including pyrotechnics, but the spokesperson didn't know what group was performing the exercises. And that seems kind of odd for the fire department to say they know about the exercises and the parachuters and the possible use of pyrotechnics, but not to know who the responsible party was, especially in Phoenix. It's a dry area, and they have a lot of regulations here on fires outside and pyrotechnic usage. So it seems odd that the fire department would say they know about it, but not know about it. And then later, to add to the strangeness of this story, an alternative explanation was offered by the U.S. Air Force. Flares. That's a story we've heard before. The U.S. Air Force alleges that the lights were simply flares from the Barry Goldwater Range, the same explanation given for the Phoenix lights of 1997. But, you know, witnesses aren't buying either of these explanations.
Yeah, it's funny that it's like these authorities feel like they have to jump on the bandwagon and they need to be the first ones to identify, you know, what these things are.
Well, and again, that's atypical for, you know, how this is usually handled by officials and by the military. You know, usually if any alleged explanation is given by them, it comes weeks or months later. You know, we wait forever to hear some sort of explanation, some official word from the officials, and it either doesn't come or it comes much later. But this, right out of the bat, the Air Force puts up an explanation, but that explanation contradicts what the fire department's explanation was.
Mm-hmm.
So, again,
I wonder what some of the other, like what's the transportation guy's going to say, or the schools, education, are they going to say, oh no, that was us, we were launching, you know, some...
We had a birthday party and we lost our balloons.
Yep.
It's interesting to hear all the different theories and explanations that come forward, but again, it makes it difficult to find out what actually is going on and
mm-hmm.
what's information and what is disinformation. Well, for some reason, the U.S. media seems to be hypersensitive to UFO sightings at the moment, but that isn't the case for residents in Oregon's Central Coast. The area is so used to almost daily UFO sightings that locals have been nearly desensitized to them. Some of the locals are even getting annoyed by all the tourists, researchers, and other visitors swarming on the area to catch a glimpse of their own UFO.
That would be exciting to live in a place where you don't have to worry about having to go skywatch for a long period of time to see a UFO. You can just go outside and look. And yeah, definitely we need to get to know who these people are so we can go up there and videotape what they're getting or seeing.
Yeah. If any of our listeners have regular sightings in Oregon or anywhere, we'd love to hear from you because we'd love to come see you.
Yeah. Take some pictures and get some video too, just for the heck of it. And
absolutely.
Send it our way.
If you've got pictures or video, we'll be happy to maybe throw it on the show. And for those of you who don't know, we have a live video stream going of the radio show right now. You can watch a video right along with the show. You can go to openminds.tv to watch that. And as Alejandro mentioned, we do archive the shows. Every show is available online later for your viewing or listening at any time. We do have it on YouTube in high definition. And that high definition YouTube video, we also add to our website, to the archives of the radio show on our website. So you can watch that right from openminds.tv as well.
And we got Jason right down there in the corner.
And for those not watching the video, you won't know what Alejandro's talking about. But
well, most people are, right?
Yeah, well, we look like the Brady Bunch in our different boxes. Denver's initiative is finally coming up. This is exciting. November elections are just around the corner, and this election is when voters in Denver, Colorado will finally get to vote on Initiative 300, the initiative that Jeff Peckman has been spearheading that would create an extraterrestrial affairs commission in Denver. More than 10,000 signatures were collected to get the initiative on the ballot, and if it passes, the commission will put UFO and extraterrestrial information on the city of Denver's website. They will evaluate potential risks and benefits of interacting with extraterrestrial visitors, and they will establish procedures for Denver residents to report sightings of UFOs and or extraterrestrial beings. The commission will not use taxpayer money, but will rely solely on grants and donations.
Yep, it's exciting, finally, because he's been trying to do this for a couple of years. Of course, we've had him on the show. I think we've had him on like three times now to talk about his initiative. And it's finally gotten on the ballot after a lot of work. And it's going to be voted on. And, of course, everybody's very excited to see how it will go and if Denver will actually vote to have an extraterrestrial affairs committee. But then, of course, even if they did, from there the city has to build it and they need to get some funds to run it. And, of course, like you said, in order to it not to be a taxpayer burden, it's written so it will run solely on donations.
That's right. And it's exciting that this is right around the corner. It seems like we've been talking about this forever.
Mm-hmm.
And soon we'll know what's going to happen.
We'll finally know.
This is cool news about NASA, more NASA news. Pete Warden, director of NASA's Ames Center, has announced an initiative called the 100-Year Starship, aimed at taking space flight to the next level. NASA hasn't released any details about the initiative yet, but Warden believes the agency is now focusing
where somehow a microwave beam is sent into space and this solar-like device is able to capture that beam and it pushes the craft forward. It's something that doesn't seem that practical, but maybe they've built some kind of additions to it that make it more practical. But it's really exciting. That's not really Star Trek-ish. So, and he's talking about Star Trek-type technologies. So it'll be exciting to hear what he has to say. Unfortunately, we're not going to
know
until next year.
Well, I don't know if he's talking about the technology or just the look of the ships.
Oh, yeah. That could be, too.
Yeah. I mean, he wants to – his statement said that their efforts will emulate the starships depicted on Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
So it could refer to simply the design of the ships.
Yeah, which would have like a disc type of portion to it, a large
They all
dish
didn't have
part.
A saucer section.
Yeah. But many did.
The cool ones did.
Yeah.
Remember when NASA blasted a hole in the moon last year? Well, they just announced last week that they found much more water than they were expecting. NASA estimates there to be nearly 1 billion gallons of water in the crater that was hit, enough water to fill 1,500 Olympic-sized swimming pools. And that's just one crater on the moon.
Yeah, that's really exciting that the moon should have so much water. And, of course, water being the big thing that and temperature, but being a big part of producing life, that's really exciting.
It is exciting. And, you know, they're finding more out about the moon than they've known before. Not only does it have, it seems to be rich in water, it's also rich in a lot of other resources. They found a lot of silver, I guess, on the moon, which is interesting.
There's a lot of stuff up there, and that's why some people feel that, for better or worse, that we should be up there and, you know, harvesting all of this stuff and bringing it back to Earth, because they feel it's a good way to be able to get these resources. Some of them, like I've heard of H3, a type of resource that could be used for propulsion, because it's a very volatile mixture of hydrogen, and that's very difficult to make, but that there's an abundance up there.
Interesting that we're finding out so much about the closest body to us now when we're doing all this other exploration in deep space.
Yep.
It's good to know that they're finally getting to work.
Yeah.
All right, that is it for the news. Remember to check out these stories and more at openminds.tv, your source for UFO-related news. I'm your Open Minds news correspondent, Jason McClellan, and you've been briefed. Back to you, Alejandro.
Thank you, Jason. And other Open Minds website news, we put up today the review for AD After Disclosure. Of course, we had one of the authors, Bryce Zabel, on a few weeks ago, and we talked about this exciting book. But you can read our review, which will also be going into the magazine. And that book actually is for sale today. So you can go there also to see the link where you can get your copy of the book. It's going to be great. And actually, Richard Dolan, one of the authors, is going to be at the Bay Area Expo this weekend also. So you'll be able to get the book from him and get it signed. If you're not going to make it to that and you'll make it to the Congress, you'll also be a speaker there so you can get your book signed. And it's a great book. I think a lot of you, I think most people listening to the show who ponder about the possibility of disclosure, how it might happen, if it might happen, what might happen, should it happen, and the ramifications on things like religion or other aspects of society like the economy, then you're going to love this book because there's a lot of very educated speculation around that. And it's a lot of fun to read, and it really gets your mind thinking about maybe some of the aspects of disclosure you haven't thought about before. So you can go to the front page of our website, read the review, see what you think, you know, and there's a link there for the book itself. And go check that out if you think you need to get it. And then also we posted a story in the last week from the Wendell Stevens Archive of an amazing photograph from Puerto Rico in the 90s. And it looks kind of like one of those pictures that are too good to be true. Maybe it is, but it does come with a photo analysis that was done. And the person who analyzed the photo put his report, we put his report up on the website with the photo, and he seems to think that it is not a hoax and that is a real picture. So you're going to have to check that out as well. And of course, we update that on a regular basis with all of our news. So that's some of the stuff going on the website. But now I want to get to our guest so we can talk about some World War II UFOs. And I believe we have Keith on the line. Keith, are you there?
Hey, Alejandro. How are you?
Great. How are you doing?
Very good. Good to be on your show.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you and to talk about this subject, because I guess one of the first things to start with is the idea of Foo Fighters. One point you make is that There's more going on in World War II than just these Foo Fighters, and you distinguish a difference between the UFOs and Foo Fighters.
Yes. What took place in World War II was the term Foo Fighter came about not until late 1944, and that term was put into print after the 415th Night Fighter Squadron started seeing these strange lights over Germany and Europe. And so what is a misconception is that all UFO sightings during World War II were called the Foo Fighters, where in fact it was only a term used over three or four months in late war. The sightings had begun in the early 30s and continued into the war under various names such as the Light, the Thing. The British used the term balls of fire. And then in the Pacific Theater, after Germany had surrendered, balls of fire then became the term utilized by the American Air Forces on their way towards Japan.
Right. And so I've heard that, you know, the other, I probably got it from maybe your website or an excerpt from your book that the other, like the German or the English and our other allies didn't know or use the term Foo Fighters.
Correct. And the term, from what I gather, I spoke with the commanding officer of the 415th Night Fighter Squadron. I interviewed him for the book. And it was his men who named it, and they pretty much came up with the name after the Smokey Stover cartoon in the 1940s, which was very popular with the veterans, the airmen, servicemen overseas. And that cartoon, the fire engine, was called the Foo-mobile.
Hmm.
And so it was just a funny name. And it's important to know that the men would come up with names to describe something they didn't understand. So they could have said balloon, meteor, falling star, comet, whatever. It was a real host of names. And that was one of the interesting things I came upon during the research, was I had to decipher, were these very unusual objects that were being observed or just normal phenomenon or known aircraft that were unidentified? Because it was very important to know that during the combat missions, these objects were considered German technology at first. But as the war progressed and as the men became acclimated with the sightings, they realized that the technology was far superior than conventional technology of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what really got the ball rolling, and investigations were then brought into play. We know that investigations go back as far as 1943 for sure, but I'm sure they were already in place by the time the British, you know, were combating the Germans in the open years of the war.
Mm-hmm. So what inspired you at first to look into this particular aspect of UFOs?
Well, in 1989, after about two or three years of serious research into the subject, I became very enthralled with it. I had a childhood sighting in the mid-60s, but that was very brief. And then by the 80s, there was a real influx of books coming out. In 1987, of course, the book that really lit the fire was Whitley Strieber's Communion. And Bud Hopkins had released Intruders, and Gary Kinder had been following the Billy Meier case with Light Years. So these three books hit the shelf at a time where it just really attracted my attention. So during that time, I had uncovered a story in a nearby where I lived in Frederick, Maryland, of a student who was told by her teacher, the whole class, that she had overheard a conversation while working in the Pentagon in 1970. And so that had to do with a alien craft and occupants that apparently were being stored or they were discussing. This teacher at the time was working for the Office of Civil Defense. She was a CETA employee, meaning she was hired by the Civilian Employment Training Agency as a summer hire to give her employment while she was going to college. That put her in the Pentagon as a secretary to a Colonel Sullivan, who was, of course, the director of the Office of Civil Defense. And one day, while she was at work, other military officers came into the office and sat down and discussed having a UFO and occupants in custody. And were trying to determine, should the press know, should the public know, what should they do with them? And that's pretty much the extent of her story. That's all she heard.
Wow.
She was a college student, and she tried her best not to eavesdrop, but it was really one large office, and that was it. So she was really shoulder to shoulder with them. And so I decided to look further into that, and I knew at the time one of the leading researchers in the country for crash and retrievals at the time was Mr. Leonard Stringfield. And so out of the blue, I just called him up one day and said, look, I have this case. Would you be interested in guiding me through an investigation, how to interview the subject and approach the matter and fill me in? He was more than glad to help. And so during that time, I heard firsthand Mr. Stringfield's World War II sighting, which was absolutely fascinating. And I knew at one point I wanted to look more into the World War II sightings. And so by 1999, I was able to devote full-time research into World War II specifically. So I went to National Archives in College Park. I made weekly, biweekly visits for 4 years and just dove into the records. I really just scraped the tip of the iceberg. But at that point, I accumulated enough to know that there, one, was indeed a phenomenon. Two, it was investigated during the war, which, mm-hmm. of course, many up to the time the release of my book had suspected. No, there was not enough manpower. We had a major conflict going on, and we just didn't have time to follow aliens, UFOs, and things like that. But we have to remember the term UFO did not exist.
Right.
One, and two, the United States and the British, the Allies, were scared to death of German technology, which was advancing at an alarming rate.
Mm-hmm.
Aeronautically, in World War II, they were estimated to be 15 to 25 years more advanced than anyone.
Right. Well, and they had things like jets and other technologies. And just like today, especially during wartime, you want to capture these advanced technologies so you can start to utilize them.
That's right.
Catch
and
up.
A great effort to do that. So there, these reports that were coming in were high strangeness, and they were technological because they were describing physical craft, mm-hmm. in many cases. And some of the cases are really straight out of the pages of pulp science fiction,
mm-hmm.
but most of them were just lights or that were in the sky with them, but they were performing at a remarkable advantage over what we had in the sky at the time.
Mm-hmm. Was there a document that you had come across, or perhaps many, that specifically kind of gave you the proof that there was an active investigation going on?
Yes. First of all, the one document that I needed before I started the investigation, I wanted to have at least one document in my hands that made me feel there was a UFO-type phenomenon occurring during the war.
Right.
So I found that in the 1953 CIA-hosted panel report, the Robertson panel, which were a team of scientists, national scientists, that were hosted by the CIA, put together to determine if UFOs were a national security threat. Because by late 1952... of course, we had the flyovers in Washington, and UFO sightings were everywhere, not just in the United States, but around the world. So they were trying to determine if this was indeed a national security threat. In that report, interestingly enough, they mentioned the Foo Fighters. Now, they say that it was St. Elmo's fire. They believed it was St. Elmo's fire. But what was remarkable, that particular report, there was a section in it that was called On Lack of Danger. That was a section. And in that, I quote, If the term flying saucers had been popular in 1943 through 1945, these objects would have been so labeled. And so to me, that said there was more to the story, because I for one, believe that the Robertson Powell report is still a watered-down version that we do have.
Mm-hmm.
So interestingly enough, heading that panel was Dr. H.P. Robertson. So we jump forward now to my investigation in the archives. So I was finally able to, after several years, find the one document that showed there was an investigation of the Foo Fighters, and this was authorized by General Eisenhower's office, SHAFE, the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force. His command authorized this investigation. He asked his scientific advisor to look into the phenomenon, the Foo Fighters. Now, the phenomenon had not been reported in the press until January 1945. And I believe that if it had not made it into the AP wire, we probably wouldn't have heard of the subject. But it was out, so SHAFE looked into it because people were asking. So he sent his scientific advisor, asked him to look into it. That scientific advisor for General Eisenhower was Dr. Robertson. So he went into 1953 with knowledge of the phenomenon. So that right there was one official investigation. I also found another official investigation that General Spatz, who was then in charge of the United States Tactical Air Force, had an investigation going. The British had an investigation going that started in 1943-44, and they called it Rocket Phenomena.
Hmm.
That was the name of theirs. That was what they were using as a term. General Arnold also had a staff member, Colonel Joseph Chamberlain, who he asked personally to look into the subject. And he actually, Colonel Chamberlain, actually went around and investigated, including the 415th Night Fighter Squadron. I went to the Library of Congress after Jan Aldridge, a behind-the-scenes, basically, researcher in the United States, gave me a tip. And I went in there and actually found the notes. So we have that. But in the Robertson Powell report, the most knowledgeable person who was investigating the phenomenon was a Dr. David T. Griggs. Dr. David T. Griggs was attached to every intelligence operation during the war, all the way to the Manhattan Project. He was a radar expert, and he worked out of the War Department. So Dr. James McDonald, who was an atmospheric physicist, who's real famous in terms of UFO history, he actually called and spoke in 1969 to Dr. Griggs. And his notes I obtained them through the University of Arizona. And, yes, Dr. Griggs was asked by General Arnold, who was then the commanding officer of the Allied United States Air Forces, to investigate the Foo Fighters not only in Europe but in the Pacific Theater of Operations. And he determined that there was a phenomenon. It seemed that the European sightings were different than the ones in the Pacific. And he had written reports of his findings, which he did not really find an answer, even though he went into Japan with the troops and investigated it. But those reports have never been found.
Mm-hmm.
So that, in a nutshell, is the concrete elements that really substantiate there was a phenomenon occurring during the war.
That's really interesting that he notes that there was a different phenomenon in Europe than the Pacific theater, like you mentioned. Did he mention, do you recall what particular differences there were?
I believe at the time the notes of Dr. McDonald, who interviewed Dr. Griggs, indicated,
gotcha.
Well, the Foo Fighters, one, were these circular lights. And they would come in 1-2-3s. They would fly in a triangular formation. They would be the size of a baseball to the size of a full moon. And that was the typical Foo Fighter sighting. But again, we have to realize that these sightings were just a particular group of sightings that were being reported along with others that were other operating type of craft. They would see wings. They would see exhaust that seemed to never go out, so that ruled out jets. But the Pacific Theater sightings, though they didn't call them Foo Fighters, they called them balls of fire.
Mm-hmm.
And it was similar in that they were a light that seemed to glow, pulsate, and be able to stay in the air for hours and fly along the B-29s. But among that, those sightings were ordnance that were like rockets and flares and parachute torpedoes. They would take high-altitude aircraft and drop chains and everything you can think of, the Japanese were throwing in the sky. So as an intelligence officer during World War II, when your men were coming back from a mission to report, they were trying to describe things, and they would say, it looked like a fire extinguisher. It looked like two balls in a chain. It looked like a small submarine with wings. They just had this whole host that they tried to accommodate into a report for General LeMay and make sense of it. So it's a little confusing what Dr. Griggs was saying as far as that he thought they were different. I think they were the same when you look at all the material I found. It's just that he apparently, in his discussion with Dr. McDonald, was not really giving the whole story, because Dr. McDonald's notes felt that he wrote that Dr. Griggs was not telling him everything.
Oh, go ahead.
Dr. Griggs went on to work for the RAND Corporation after the war, which is a very important Air Force project. And so there was, of course, a lot of secrecy. And this is 1969, right when the Condon Report was just ending. Yes. So.
And RAND is a very, well-known for the major secrecy. They do a lot of the think tank work for defense and designing wars, and things like that they were hired for, and highly secret kind of company.
Exactly. And before they became the RAND Corporation in 1948, they were called Project RAND during the war. And it was the Douglas Aircraft Company and General Arnold who had the foresight to think outside the box. It was his idea to think future Air Force. By April 1945, Germany was defeated. They knew it was coming to a close. They knew it was going to be a vicious battle in the Pacific, but that would soon come to a close. And so General Arnold decided that he wanted his top men to put together a report looking into the future. Think science fiction. Think outside the box. We want an Air Force. So he basically asked them to look 25 years out, write up the reports, and he would compile it. And I believe the book that came out was Beyond Horizons or something to that effect. It was very groundbreaking at the time. And, of course, he had access to all the German technology that was coming in from the captured laboratories, the scientists, the documentation. It was a major situation that was occurring. And even up to probably March, April 1945, we were not sure that Germany did not have an atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
There was an intelligence mission that was specifically after that. It was the priority mission to determine. And they were racing from town to town right with the troops. And so it goes hand in hand thinking, if they were worried about Germany still having an atomic weapon, and that meant that, and these strange aircraft being seen, if they were German technology, add them together and you have a delivery device that could really cause a change in the way the war turned out.
Right. Very scary stuff. So you talked about some of the sightings or some of the experiences that were reported as being real out there, like from pulp science fiction. What was one of the first ones you ran across like that?
The first major one came to my attention from a researcher, Wendy Connors, and she provided me a tape of a Captain Raymond Stabinski. This is June 25th, 42. And he was pilot of a Wellington bomber. They had just conducted a bombing mission over the Ruhr Valley, the industrial area for Germany, because that was where we had decided to hit Germany and just bring them to their knees. So he was out flying. They had just flown over Holland. They were over this, out over open water. And one of his crewmen said that there was a what he thought might be a rocket approaching the aircraft. It was a ball, a copper ball, colored ball. This was nighttime. And it quickly gained on them. And by the time it reached within, I'd say, 1,000 or so yards, it was the size of a full moon. It was solid copper color, like a setting sun. That's, I think, one of the quotes. And so Stabinski took the aircraft into evasive action. The object kept with them every maneuver they performed. In some instances, it was able to cross over from one wing to another very quickly, which was astonishing. And at that point, two of his gunners opened up on the object. Interestingly enough, the tracer rounds were entering or hitting the object. It was just like it was being absorbed. And it was definitely close enough they knew they were within range. But there was nothing coming out the other side. And it was causing no effect whatsoever on the object.
Wow.
This put him into a panic, and he came. Finally, when he landed, he ran in for debrief. And the first thing out of the intelligence officer's mouth were he and his crew were drinking. It was nothing but ridicule.
Wow.
So he knew to shut up because he didn't want to be grounded. And he started asking some of the pilots coming in after he landed. And they, too, had seen an object that was similar, but they knew better than reported because, again, early in the war, they were not being taken seriously.
Well, and even for decades afterwards, probably to this day that happens. That's a story you hear over and over where people maybe wonder, like this incident, I've heard, not this particular incident, but similar type of thing where, let's say, a Navy ship, I've heard a gentleman who had sightings and tried to report them. And then when they talked to their friends and asked, you know, did you have this experience? Yeah, I did, but I was smart enough not to say anything about it. But, it, you know, this whole trend of don't say anything so you don't get in trouble.
Yeah, it was very difficult. But during the war, what the unique aspect of this was, by mid-war, the intelligence command realized, hey, we cannot afford to have these men not tell us what they're seeing.
Right.
Because what if it is advanced technology and we're not prepared? So there was a big change in attitude. By 44, they started to take the reports. They weren't being ridiculed, but they weren't acting like it was anything special. Some instances, crew would tell them about an object that was huge, and they say, okay, thank you, and that would be it. So obviously it was being passed on to higher commands.
Mm-hmm.
By November of 42, the first piece of documentation to come out that showed there was something being observed that was really causing the crews to become unnerved was discovered by British researchers Andy Roberts and Dr. David Clark. And this had to do with a sighting over Turin, Italy. And a bomber crew, reported seeing an object that was about 200 to 300 feet long, and it was traveling around 500 miles per hour. The object had four red lights equally distanced along its body. At first, they thought it was four objects, but then they realized it was one. It was traveling low below them in the Alps. And so the report that they uncovered, let me pull it up here. I quote from this report. Herewith a copy of a report received from a crew of a Lancaster after raid on Turin. The crew refuses to be shaken in their story in the face of the usual banter. So that right there tells it all.
Mm-hmm.
The stories coming in were just too remarkable because the British at the time felt, well, there's no way Germans have rockets that can make 90-degree turns, or they can sustain the fuel capacity, you know, where it stays lit and illuminated for, you know, 15 minutes, 20, 30 minutes. It's one thing for a jet to turn on for a couple seconds and turn off. But these were, so obviously they were observing and reporting two distinct different types of craft or objects.
Wow, these stories are fascinating. I mean, I love this stuff. I love, you know, looking into the 50s and how everything kind of was beginning then, and the late 40s, where it seems like, you know, people were trying to still figure out, meaning the Air Force and the other armed forces are trying to figure out what to do with this phenomena. But these stories are great because they demonstrate something we don't hear as much about, is that, you know, there was an escalation of UFO activity, it would seem, during World War II.
Right. I mean, most of the literature up to several years ago indicated that the modern UFO sightings began with Kenneth Arnold sightings. Mm-hmm. And that brought in the modern era.
Right.
Of course, John Keel had done some extensive research for what they called the Scandinavian sightings, which occurred in the 1930s, preceding the war.
Mm-hmm.
And so why and how it was kept under wraps to me seems logical, because during war, the government had a great handle on media and manipulation of the public, in terms of when they told you to keep your mouth shut, you
right.
kept your mouth shut. And it was an honorable thing to do. And that generation of people in the 40s felt it was their national duty to do so.
Right.
And so the phenomenon is much larger during the war than we ever expected. Of course, the gun camera footage that we hear about, the great, all the photographs, because cameras were everywhere. All the fighters had, you know, had photographic squadrons. Their whole mission was to go out and photograph the terrain, the area. So you can just watch any kind of World War II documentary and see just from the combat footage. So we know the footage exists, but there's not one really credible photograph or motion picture that we've uncovered yet, which I believe is still buried deep in the Pentagon.
Well, and I know recently kind of the UK, at least, and you probably knew about this prior, kind of tipped their hand in some of the files that came forward recently, where there was a story, and I'd like to hear what you think of this story, about Churchill being aware of a sighting and being shown some information about UFOs and then wanting to keep the information secret. And the UK's response to the gentleman who made the inquiry about this case was that they had destroyed all UFO research or information prior than the 60s because there was no public interest in it.
Yeah, the British claim to have destroyed most of World War II records, which is just, to me, unbelievable that, you know, Britain would not have a sense of history. Now, I think there's something that we have to read between the lines here. And to go back to that particular story now, interestingly, this story that was released was the documentation of the grandson of a bodyguard, a Royal Air Force bodyguard for Churchill.
Right.
And it was his grandfather who told the story that during his work with Churchill, he overheard a conversation between he and General Eisenhower discussing UFOs. And that was something his grandfather had told him over and over as a child. It was known in the family. So it was the grandson's inquiry about his grandfather's records. So that's what got released to the public, not the report.
Right.
So again, it's nailed down. And, you know, I still think that one of the things that the agencies in the United States will do, I'm convinced, is that they'll say, you'll file a FOIA. Let's say I want UFO records from 1952 or something. And they'll say, we're sorry, no records exist. Well, that's true. No records exist. And they're talking about paper form.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that maybe the paper records were destroyed, but you can bet they were microfilmed, or there is some type of documentation that they really, I don't think that the FOIA is nearly as effective as it was meant to be. And I believe that in the beginning it was very effective because none of the agencies really, in 1970, I believe 75, 77, when it was enacted, ever believed in the 40s, 50s, and 60s that such a thing would occur, that the general public could access secret records. So there was a big behind-the-scenes thing happening, I believe, that really pretty much redesignated the records. They've changed the name, so if you don't ask for the correct name, you don't get the file. And it's not like the people who pull these records know anything. They're just going after what you file.
Right.
They're just hourly employees. So
yeah, and a lot of them, you know, I'm sure they've come up with, you know, loopholes. And as we know, you know, the government doesn't necessarily have a lot of control over itself. And there's some departments that feel they're above the law and just won't comply. And some of them are powerful enough that nobody can tell them any different.
Right. It's, you know, it's really a minefield, and there's a lot of misinformation, disinformation. And, of course, you know, sometimes we accuse an agency of knowing more than they do, and maybe
right.
they don't. It's just, it's really the deny, 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 keep it quiet element
mm-hmm.
in the United States government is pretty effective.
I wanted to ask you about MacArthur and, of course, his statements about expecting a UFO attack or an alien attack in the future, the next great war. Do you know much about what MacArthur might have based that comment on?
The only thing, when I was researching, the only thing I suspected was he had access to the files that indicated that there was something in the air that was not conventional and not of this earth.
Mm-hmm.
And whether they had some, you know, if they had an object, if it shot any down, unknown. But it seems to me that it, from what I found and from the reports I have seen and the veterans I've spoken with, it tells me that MacArthur had an insight. He
mm-hmm.
was on the inside. So for him to make that statement, it could have been just off the cuff or something that was, you know, it couldn't get him in a lot of trouble, but it was kind of like a message, like General Eisenhower's military-industrial complex
mm-hmm.
statement. You had it was a statement that got out there. You didn't know a whole lot about it, but it was something important. So that's all. I never found anything to indicate that he knew anything during the war. But given that General Eisenhower was telling his chief scientific advisor to investigate the night phenomenon, and that's what they called it in the actual reports, it tells me that at the Chafe level, MacArthur was aware. So, anything else would
something.
Be speculation.
Right.
Yeah.
What about crashes? Did you come across any UFO crash documentation during World War II?
None. Again, all I was getting were the statements within mission reports.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you have the witness testimony that I accumulated that had been generated through magazines and books in the 60s and 70s, and I tried to
gotcha.
Get everything I could within that. But what's interesting is that during the war, coming in right with the troops at Normandy, the United States Army Air Force had what they called air technical intelligence teams.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a team of two or three guys in a Jeep. And they had what they called a blacklist or a blue list. I believe it was blue list. And this was a list that was generated out of Wright Field by the engineers of what to look for. They were to go in and look for aircraft, weapons, facilities, scientists, you name it. Get in there and get it so we can exploit it. So they had crash teams, which were assigned to go in and grab the downed German jets or German aircraft and get them back into our hands. And if they were a jet or a new design, study them. So this was in place. So if a crashed object, UFO, had come down, it would have been a team like this. So by the time 1947 rolls around and we have the Roswell incident, it was pretty much something that had been well-established, a well-oiled machine in place, I feel. And that's why we there was such a quick response. It was something that was probably already in place since World War II. And if indeed we shot down something that was extraterrestrial, it would have been that type of operation that would have been on top of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure there were extractions that were possibly even across enemy lines where they had to be very stealthily and very quick. So they had protocols for that type of thing.
Oh, they really did. And you say the stealth operation, and what brings to mind is another unit that was operating as they were like a band of cowboys. They called them 30AU, and they were British Marines. And they were the prototype for the ATI, the Air Technical Intelligence Teams at D-Day. These 30AU was a British team that had been in operation since the invasion of Sicily, and it was their mission to get in there and find, like I said, the documentation, the scientists, whatever. And they were acting as a rogue band in terms of they answered to no one. And they dressed, their dress was not according to the standards. It really caused a lot of, you know, the other officers did not trust them. They weren't too happy with their conduct. Hmm. But interestingly, they were led by no other than Ian Fleming of the James Bond.
And wow.
A lot of his stories were his time at Whitehall at the Air Ministry, and it was he who was setting up this intelligence operation. And it was he alone, not alone, but who was involved with the overall exploitation of Germany.
If Ian Fleming was in charge, then their strange, unconventional outfits must have been some sort of jumpsuit over a tuxedo so they could be ready for any occasion.
It was his idea. So
that's incredible.
To these missions. So he was definitely in the know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which a lot of people suspect that some intelligence people got involved with the entertainment industry during that period of time. So that's I've heard some things about Ian Fleming, but that really kind of brings it home with you explaining the air technical intelligence teams and what they do. That's very interesting.
Yes, they were very important, but like I said, the most important mission that would have been on top of the aerial phenomena also was called the ALSOS mission, which was the Manhattan Project's intel team.
Mm-hmm.
And that was headed by Dr. Samuel Goudsmit. And these men were scientists. They dressed in military uniform. Their rank was usually designated as per their position in civilian life. And they would go in, and his mission was to get in there and find out if, of course, they had the atomic bomb. And the important thing is I found reports that he was personally writing on rocketry and on aircraft. And so they were wondering, you know, about a delivery device. And if these Foo Fighters, these balls of fire, mm-hmm. were technology, they could really deliver a serious blow to the Allied nations. And the Germans were definitely wanting to hit New York with an atomic bomb. That documentation exists. They were designing bombers for it. And there's no doubt. So there was a real race to uncover all this.
Well, I want to hear some more about maybe another of these stories, because I love these stories of these, especially these more dramatic experiences.
Okay, well, that I personally heard myself, one of the most dramatic experiences was Mr. Stringfield's.
Uh-huh.
And what's interesting, Sergeant Stringfield, Leonard Stringfield, it was August 28th, 1945. War had ended, and he was in a C-46 transport aircraft. He was with the intelligence people. He was intelligence command with the 5th Air Force. His mission was to fly into the Isugi Aerodrome in Japan and set up shop for the influx of American troops coming in. So it was... he was out over open water. It was between the islands of Ioshima and Iwo Jima. And he looked out his window and saw three phosphorus-colored, magnesium-colored, about the size of a dime at arm's length, come out of a cloud bank and fly parallel with his aircraft. Seconds later, he heard commotion in the cockpit, and the co-pilot came back and said, prepare for a crash landing. And so, of course, everyone was frightened over that, and they were losing altitude. Mr. Stringfield looked out the window, and this probably took over a 30-second period, and saw the three objects go back into a cloud bank and disappear. And about that time, they regained altitude in his aircraft. So they made an emergency landing at Ioshima, and he got out of the aircraft and noticed that oil had leaked all the way down the left side of the aircraft, and he found out that there had been some type of problem with the controls. The compasses were spinning. They were losing. Nothing was working properly. And so he was unable to actually speak with the pilots. They were whisked away for briefing, debriefing. And he had a mission to do, so really after that, they had to get on with their mission, and not much was said. And so that started his interest, and according to Richard Hall, who was a personal friend of Mr. Stringfield, that incident caused him to never fly again once he got out of the service in November 1945. He took mass transit or drove.
Wow. So definitely had quite an effect.
Quite an effect. And so here we are in August 28th, 1945. Japan has surrendered. We had air superiority. And here were three. And this was a daylight sighting. This is during daylight. So he was able to look at it. And he said he was aware of the Foo Fighters sightings that were being generated in the intelligence reports. But Mr. Stringfield had no idea there were so many sightings being generated during the war. And he definitely knew that whatever he was seeing was not aircraft that he was aware of. Mm-hmm. He felt they were intelligently controlled and they were flying in formation. And again, that burning magnesium, you know, no type of physical body could be seen. So that again goes right all the way up to today of some of the science that we see today.
Well, and for the listeners who don't know, Leonard Stringfield then went on to be a major researcher, and he pretty much began the UFO crash research.
Right. He started that in the late 70s, and of course he had been researching since in the early 50s. And he decided to focus on the crash and retrieval because he had come across so many things. And I think he wrote 7 status reports, what he calls status reports, on the subject. And but he has quite a rich history. In the 50s, he would filter UFO reports from his home. He had a phone number and a code that he worked with the Air Defense Command Center in the area in Ohio. And I think his code was Foxtrot Kilo 30 Blue. He wrote a book with that name, with Kilo 30 Blue. And it was upon his call, he would receive all the sightings from his different ground corps observers or civilian, whatever. If he felt that it warranted an unknown, he had access to the Air Defense Command, who would then send up jets. So he did that for several years. Then, he became heavily involved with the original NICAP. And he was involved with the Condon University investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And it never ended. He was an advisor to the United Nations in 1978 when Gordon Cooper made his announcement that he, during the 50s, saw flights of aircraft flying higher than the known best aircraft we had in our possession. So he had quite a body of work assembled that he was drawing from. And, of course, then, like you said, the crash retrieval thing took over. And that's why I contacted him to begin my research with the 1989 and the teacher.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, a popular theory is that a lot of UFOs, more so than we know, or and perhaps the entire phenomena, is due to Nazi technology developed during World War II that has been kept in secret even to this day, but it's more advanced than even our technology of this day. Do you find any credence to that theory?
I find it plausible,
mm-hmm.
absolutely, because, like I said, it was known at the time that the Germans were 15 to 25 years more advanced than we were aeronautically. And right up to the end of the war, I mean, we were going into German laboratories, and the scientists and engineers were still working on projects. So there was many, many projects that were still on the drawing board. And there is no doubt that we uncovered things that was exploited for the Cold War. That's just a logical thing, because before the war ended, we were at war with the Russians, and the command knew it, so that exploitation had to take place, because if we weren't going to get it, the Russians were.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was that battle. But what throws a kink in that story is in 1948, after the alleged estimate of the situation, which was a report generated out of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base by the engineers in Project Sign, who were investigating the phenomenon, wrote that it was likely that we were dealing with something extraterrestrial. That report went up the chain of command, but was slapped down because there was no way that was going to be what they determined these sightings were, for whatever reason. And the reports included where we were going into Germany in 1948 and hunting down some of the aircraft designers that we had in our possession in 1945, but we let them go. And these were people who were designing Delta aircraft, A-shaped aircraft, and just finding out, is there something that we didn't understand, or is something that they knew and they weren't telling us? So they were going back in and getting these guys and interrogating them. So if it was something that was being exploited, it was used in 1947, like for Roswell, then why in 48 were they still puzzled?
Right.
So there's a lot of inconsistencies, but it's a very plausible scenario. I understand where the researchers are coming from. I find it fascinating, and there's some truth to it. There is an element of truth to it. But like I said, with some of the signs that were being reported in World War II, there's no way that was something that today we still don't know about. Because, again, one of the most, like, the Pulp Fiction sightings I was telling you about also came from Andy Roberts and Dr. David Clark, occurred in 1944. And RAF pilots Brian Frau and Ronald Claridge said that they had observed, and they drew pictures for them, an enormous disc-shaped craft. And when they came upon it in their bomber, it was hanging motionless in the sky. The light reflecting on it from the moon, they could tell there were portholes along it. And the object was at least five times the size of their bomber.
Wow.
When they approached it, it shot straight out of sight at what they estimated a remarkable speed, had to be in the thousands of miles per hour, but there was no sound or exhaust. They reported it to the intelligence officers, but again, the reports were taken, and they were informed of nothing. So, of course, that official report has not been found. So these are the more extraordinary sightings that are very numerous, that there's no way that Germans would have an aircraft like that.
Right. And like you say,
so,
and it would make sense that there are technologies that were possibly gleaned from the Nazis that we don't know about because they're still in secret projects. But to explain
absolutely
the entire phenomenon is a little difficult.
Yes. No. When you look at the phenomenon throughout all the decades, if you look at it specifically through the eyes of World War II, it's going to be looked at as German technology with these men were drunk, it was war nerves, they misidentified something, it was optical illusions. So there was that that going on. But as, of course, the war ended, the sightings continued.
Now, go ahead.
That's it. That's fine.
I was going to say in the 50s, you know, that the whole contactee movement became very popular. People claiming to speak to the pilots and the occupants of these craft. Not that, you know, ETs were maybe as much in the zeitgeist back in World War II, but did you ever come across any sort of story of anybody claiming some extraordinary communications like that?
Well, there are stories that were being generated from the civilian, and my book did not include civilian sightings. And
mm-hmm.
there were reports in the 40s where civilians were encountering beings or the objects at close range and seeing beings on the outside. But I don't recall hearing where they were actually communicating with them. Of course, it's not my expertise, and I don't want to do injustice to researchers who have put a lot of time in this, but no, I did not. I wasn't aware of any of that. The contactee movement, of course, came on the scene in the 50s, and here again we go to the situation where it leaves a lot of people scratching their head.
Right.
And here's where what I started to look into was the work of Dr. Jacques Vallée, because Dr. Vallée at the time, I guess to this day, still believes that if the phenomenon was strictly nuts and bolts, he'd be very disappointed. So we're dealing with a situation where if the phenomenon is multifaceted, which it most likely is, it demonstrates a unique ability to do many things, and that is manifest itself the way it wants to. He suggests that maybe that the technological objects that were being seen changes with the technological advances of us. There could be a host of different theories that come into play here. So I try not to go into any of that with my book or
right.
my research.
Well, like you said, even during World War II, which could have been, you know, you could argue it's the modern, when this all began, people were scratching their heads. And even to this day, the phenomena seems to be so enigmatic that it's hard for anybody to really say they've got it all figured out. In fact, the most wise researchers I know of, the more they research, the more they say that, you know, it just creates even more questions.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. It becomes frustrating, and then, of course, you hear about people dropping out of the field.
Right.
Or they just go into one area and just specialize in it, such as what I did with the World War II stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, which kind of gets back to what the military may know or what the government may have figured out. Do you have a sense or maybe even just an educated opinion on whether or not, you know, there are people within the government who have a lot more answers, maybe they have most of it figured out, or do you think they're still kind of scratching their heads like they were in the past?
I feel that the government or the military know a tremendous amount of information, but I don't think they have the answers. I'm not convinced that we are communicating with an alien race and conducting business like it's been suggested.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the problems is, since they don't understand it, I tend to fall into the category where I feel that if they were to reveal, the government was to reveal, or the military, that we are experiencing something in our skies that is definitely not of this earth, it would cause a situation where we would lose faith in their ability to protect us. And many people have taken polls to say that's not the case. If all the major networks would announce that we are being visited by aliens from another planet, everything would be fine. But then again, you hear the other camps discuss, well, no, the religious, the people who follow religion, that would be affected. The belief in the government would be affected. It would cause a type of chaos. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but was it Rand or the Brooklyn Institute, Brookings Institute, who wrote a report in the 60s that determined that what has happened and occurred through history, when a civilization encounters a civilization far in advance of itself, it begins to topple that particular civilization.
Yeah, I believe that was the Brookings report. And speaking of reports, I think it was a Robertson panel, which kind of concluded that, you know, this if the public found out, then our complete society would crumble and fall down. So we couldn't let people know yet about what's going on. So it's hard to say.
It really is. It really is. And, of course, by 53, I'm convinced that it was an art form in keeping this lid down.
Yeah. And especially
as far as
into
the medium manipulation.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, this book that I talked about earlier, I'm not sure if you heard that in the show, the new book by Bryce Abel and Richard Dolan called After Disclosure. Yeah, it kind of contemplates all of these things. And then you have, of course, Churchill and Eisenhower. If that story was true that we spoke about earlier, thinking that, well, we better not say anything because it'll affect religions and things like that. So it's hard to say, I guess, until it happens. I mean, I get this sense that perhaps people could handle it. But then when you read AD and you think of maybe some of these things you've never thought of, who knows? It's so difficult to say.
It really is. I mean, I personally, I would embrace it to a point where I would also be very leery of it.
Yeah.
And I think Stephen Hawking said that it may not be a good thing to encounter this. It may be, you know, quite a horrific event. And not that it was meant on their part, but the way they treat us or handle the situation may not be something we want to experience.
Mm-hmm. So they might as well just answer the question for us, disclose, and then we'll find out. That way we can get the question answered.
That's right.
Well, is there anything else you wanted to share? Let's say we should mention your book, of course. Like I said, Strange Company, Military Encounters with UFOs in World War II. It's published by Anomalous Books. So you can go to anomalousbooks.com. To purchase the book. It's on Amazon. Do you have your own website?
No, I have a blog called Stalking the Elusive Truth. I just started that a few months ago. I'm really behind with the getting the electronic media situation going. So,
yeah, it can be tough to handle. Stalking the Elusive Truth.
Yes.
Okay, great. And that's a blog that you've got. So,
yes.
All of these places, I'd definitely recommend the book to people. And, I mean, I'm so glad you're doing this kind of research. This is so very, very interesting.
Oh, I really appreciate the fact that you're interested. Your listeners are interested. And thank you so much for having me on the show.
Thank you for being on.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. That was Keith Chester, as you all know. And next week, we are having our Halloween special. And what does that mean? That means we're going to be talking ghost people. So this is going to be a show that you're going to want to listen to in the middle of the night with all the lights off. You'll probably be there anyway because in a week from today you're going to be hungover from your Halloween parties. So what we're going to do is start off the show with some EVP recordings. That's some ghost kind of research at, you know, my cousin Jason, who you know of, his group has gone on and done, and they got these incredible electric voice phenomena recordings where you hear these voices and stuff, and he'll tell us the situation behind those, and we'll play those. And then for the remainder of the hour, we're going to have Rosemary Ellen Guiley. She's a great paranormal researcher out there. She's extremely busy this time of year, off doing lectures all over the place. She's written 40-plus books already, and 9 of those being encyclopedias, her latest being the Encyclopedia of Vampire and Werewolves. But she's done a lot of UFO research, too, and I want to talk to her about some of the likenesses, and also you'll find it kind of shocking, some of the research she's done to find and have found it has some E.T. connection. So that's going to be a lot of fun. So tune in next week. Thank you for listening to the show tonight. Be sure to check out openminds.tv and register for UFO Congress at ufocongress.com. Talk to you next week.